You're listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by the team at Food Matters. Welcome to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. In these podcasts, we explore a huge range of crucial issues and exciting developments in the food industry with brilliant guests drawn from all areas of expertise. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a TV presenter and writer, and I specialize in food and science. This podcast is about the UK government's new obesity strategy, and we're going to explore what the strategy means in reality, both in terms of its impact on national obesity levels and its impact on the industry. We're really interested and what it means for manufacturers and retailers, but also how the industry could support the mainstreaming of access to healthier food options. Now, joining us to discuss it are Kate Halliwell, Head of UK Diet and Health Policy for the FDF.
Hello.
Chris Noyes, Communications Director at the Association for Convenience Stores.
Hello.
And Professor Martin Carraher, Emeritus Professor of Food and Health Policy, Centre for Food Policy, City University of London.
Hello.
Now, for the benefit of the listeners and not our panellists who know all this stuff already, I'll outline the basics of the government's new obesity strategy as we see it. They've unveiled a raft of measures to urge the nation to lose weight, to beat COVID-19 and to protect the NHS. Now, in summary, there's going to be a ban on TV and online ads for food that's high in fat, sugar and salt before 9 o'clock. End of promotional deals like bog-offs on unhealthy foods. New labelling for calories on menus to help people make healthier choices when eating out. Alcoholic drinks could soon see calorie labelling, which I've been particularly keen on for many years. There'll be a better health campaign to help people lose weight, get active and eat better, because those campaigns really work, don't they? Now, this strategy does not look at tackling the structural inequalities linked to deprivation and in turn to obesity. It doesn't look at extending the soft drinks industry levy onto unhealthy foods, which has been talked about a fair bit, and it doesn't place mandatory targets on reformulation. Now, to start off with, Professor Martin Carraher, do you think that any of these moves are going to make any tangible and quantifiable difference to obesity levels in the UK?
No, not in real terms, no. I mean, the moves are welcome, but they don't go far enough. And structurally, they're not doing much. They're just basically information campaigns, labelling and individual choice issues and trying to make people live healthier lives. And what we know from, the COVID crisis is public health at a local level is decimated. How any of this is going to be carried out is debatable.
That's quite crushing, I would say. Is there a sort of an industry-wide view on this? I mean, do people generally say, why are you doing this? Or is it just a reactionary move to please the media?
I think a lot of the headlines, as we saw them, were just that. They were headlines. The government was under pressure to be seen to be doing something rather than necessarily taking the opportunity to actually do something, which is a real shame, I think, with COVID, we do actually have this real kind of moment where a lot of people in the UK are thinking about their health, they're thinking about the health of their families. And so there could have been, this time could have been used to really help people understand how they can have a healthier diet, how they can exercise better or at all. But actually, it feels like the government has fallen back on some quite old policies and on policies that are all about banning things rather than actually trying to help people.
There's a negativity, isn't there? And I worry about negative measures alone rather than what's much more difficult to achieve, which is making healthy diets exciting and appealing and achievable. So, Chris, you represent convenience stores. And what do your members think about this?
Well, it depends which area you're looking at. Things like TV and online advertising, obviously not going to affect our members that much because it affects the whole grocery industry pretty equally. So those kind of things we're pretty neutral on. But the one thing that is potentially very, very challenging for our stores is the product sighting restrictions, moving so-called unhealthy products away from checkouts and entrances to stores. Because if you've got a very small store, so under 1,000 square feet, about a third of a tennis court, quite a very small store, if you can't put things in the entrance or by the checkout, there's not that much space left in the shop. So that's the big challenge and one that will be extremely expensive to implement as well.
Can you just give us a sense of the scale of the convenience stores in the UK? Do you have some numbers and figures to hand that you can explain their importance?
Yeah, and for the benefit of the government as well, because in their impact assessment on this, when they were looking at this earlier this year, they assumed that there were about 13,000 convenience stores in the UK when they were looking at the impact of this, when actually there are about 46,000. So about 46,000 stores, and to give you an indication of how big they are, of the independent stores in the sector, of which there are about sort of three quarters overall, so about 30,000 stores, 60% of those are under 1,000 square feet, so fit into that very small category that I'm talking about. So yeah. there are convenience stores in every, pretty much every postcode, every constituency, and lots of these are going to be pretty badly affected by this.
Yeah, okay. So, Martin, if we can come back to you, what would you have suggested that that was part of their strategy instead?
I mean, I think one of the things that they could have done is set more standards for the industry in terms of reformulation. I mean, you know, we know this works from other countries. It means consumers can choose products without having to worry about labels. We had the responsibility deal previously, which didn't work because the government didn't set standards for it. I mean, the problem is this is a free for all. I would like to point out, I think, though, in terms of a national strategy, there are different things happening in the different administrations. So Northern Ireland and Scotland are doing lots of work, and including in Scotland, they're doing lots of work with convenience stores because of the nature of convenience stores in Scotland and their importance to rural communities. So I think it's not just, the problem is this is a Westminster approach, which doesn't take account of the devolved administrations. I mean, that's the other problem we have with this.
And these convenience stores are places that that reach communities that aren't necessarily served by larger supermarkets and have a wider range of foods available, I presume. Is that right, Chris?
Yeah, that's absolutely right, yeah. And for a lot of people, they perhaps wouldn't have known that before the start of this year when we went into lockdown and had that first week of supermarket shelves being completely cleared, and then people going, oh right, where am I going to get my groceries now, and rediscovering their local shop. So yeah, lots of communities that rely on their local shop don't have any other supermarkets within quite a distance away. And you're right, yeah, the products that they offer will typically be able to get you a decent full weekly shop, and we've seen that in the last few months where people have been pretty dramatically increasing the amount of money that they're spending in convenience stores because they're buying for a much longer period of time rather than just nipping in and picking up one or two things.
Yeah. And Kate, when we're looking at these issues of a strategy, do you think that tackling individual foods and concepts like bog-offs and labelling calories is the right approach, or does something broader and more complex need to be implemented?
Something broader and more complex, but of course that actually means lots of smaller policies as well.
Yeah.
So yes, labelling is important. Obviously, we already have that on prepacked foods, which is the companies that I tend to represent. So extending that out is not a bad idea. Will it have a huge impact? Probably not. Generally speaking, people aren't really looking at the label, but absolutely the information should be there. Picking back up on something Martin was talking about on reformulation. So obviously that is looking at individual products quite literally and seeing what you can do to them. So that, I believe, is something that for our companies that make the food, is something they can look at. And actually, there are a lot of targets out there. We have a few hundred at the moment. If you look at salt and sugars, calories are still in draft. They've been draft a while, but people are still looking at it. So I think the reformulation aspect, and if you broaden that out, in fact, and started to look at ways that you could encourage maybe a bit more fibre into meals. So particularly if you think actually about things like the plant-based foods, which are starting to come through, they're quite popular. There's a lot of innovation in that space. Actually, that's a really nice way that you can start to incorporate things like, say, some lentils into sausages, a little bit of meat out, and that can actually overarching really help people without, as Martin said, them having to read and scrutinise the label. So I think those aspects are are good. They're things that the industry can do and can get behind. But I think what you also need is really targeted approaches where you're looking at the areas of deprivation and really understanding what it is and why people typically are much more likely to be obese if they're coming from lower socioeconomic groups, and how we can help and support that. And that might mean some more individual approaches or and or community-based approaches. Takes a lot of money, takes a lot of effort. And so typically I think this government has shied away from that and has gone for the kind of headlines, okay, we can do this, because actually it's not the government doing it, it's industry and supermarkets and convenience stores who have to implement.
In terms of what Kate was saying, I think that's really important. I mean, there's a number of points here. That the problem with the obesity strategy is picking on individual issues. So, you know, labelling is important, but it's part of a bigger strategy. And the problem here is the government are not looking at the wider food system. We've got a national food strategy for only for England, let's be clear. The food strategy being developed by Henry Dimbleby is only for England. But that needs to fit into the picture. So we need a raft of initiatives, including income strategies. I mean, the point here is that people on low incomes are more likely to be obese. So treating obesity is treating the symptoms, not the causes. I mean, we need to go back and see why during the COVID crisis our poverty level, food poverty levels increased by fivefold. I mean, why was that? These were people who were on the margins, you know, surviving from week to week, from income to income, don't have much savings, probably relying on credit, relying on family networks. The crisis hits, and we suddenly see a fivefold increase in food poverty. Now, that won't be tackled by the industry. That can only be tackled by government and good employment practices.
It's to be honest, it infuriates me that there's not more original thinking and dynamism to tackling these issues. It's always the same thing. Let's run a poster campaign saying eat better. Let's put some negative measures on foods. And I know, you know, on some levels the sugar tax has, by some standards, you could say it's been successful in terms of the amount of sugar that people get via soft drinks, but and yet the level of sugar that's eaten has risen overall, and yet it looks like the government's done something about it. Well, I mean, what about the original ideas? You know, how about some crazy ideas like, you know, subsidizing carrots? You know, although, you know, carrots are already pretty cheap. You know, it's not as though fresh food is expensive. The root vegetables are the cheapest things on the planet. You know, should we pay people to eat lettuce? I mean, what about some really dynamic, interesting thinking? Is anyone doing this, Martin?
Yes, I mean, there are countries doing this. I mean, Brazil, I mean, the current political climate has changed, but Brazil have a comprehensive strategy. Other countries have comprehensive strategies. I mean, maybe we should be thinking of subsidies, not just taxes. There is evidence showing that if you reward people, however that reward is, I mean, you can pay them to have healthy, to make healthy decisions in their lives. But it does need a wider approach. I mean, my fear about the strategy is it ends up blaming the industry. And I'm a critic of the industry. Don't get me wrong. You know, I think the industry does lots of things wrong. But in this instance, I just think this is handing it to the industry. And I don't think it's the industry's problem to solve. I mean, they're part of the problem, part of the solution. But I just don't see the government taking any responsibility for this.
Yeah. Now, Katie, just back to you on this idea of media campaigns. Have there been any that you feel or that your members feel have been useful and successful that have both helped people lead a healthier life and fitted in with the interests of the food and drink industry?
I mean, the one I guess that springs to mind would be Veg Power, which is an ongoing initiative at the moment, actually set up through the Food Foundation, which are a great NGO. They look at a lot of issues in the round. I would also say they are people who are thinking about solutions that are maybe a bit more innovative. Again, with Martin, I probably don't agree with everything they put out. Obviously, we have discussions, shall we say, but I think they do great work, actually. And Veg Power was a great initiative that they set up, which was really all around encouraging people to eat more veg, specifically kids. And they worked with advertisers, they worked with the broadcasters, so people like ITV were really fundamental in getting this up and running. And they've run a series of adverts last year and this year. Not quite sure what's going on currently with the COVID situation that we have. Yeah. But, you know, they were, I think, really interesting and just a different way of looking at it. So they tried to make it exciting. They deliberately targeted kids, tried to get it to, you know, it was basically a battle, but, you know, making it exciting to eat veggies. And then they rolled that further. So there were resources that went into schools that linked in to the adverts. They would have a sort of veg of the week. So, you know, carrot one week and sweet corn hero the next, that sort of stuff. But it meant that the kids were learning about it in schools. They were seeing it on the TV. A lot of the advertisers gave in kind. And then some of our companies supported as well in terms of, say someone like General Mills with sweet corn and supermarkets got on board. So it was something that everyone could get behind. I think nobody is going to disagree with trying to get children to eat veg. You know, it's like, I think it's one of those messages that everyone thinks it would be a good thing if that happened. So I think that was a really good, but that involved everybody, as opposed, I think the difference is it's not just a government designed and kind of top down, this is what we think you should do.
I'll just come in on that, on the Food Foundation, actually, because we do some work with them as well. And I'd echo what Kay said about the Veg Power campaign being really good. What Food Foundation do as well, which is just really helpful, especially in our sector and convenience stores, is things like toolkits and ways of getting retailers to be a bit less concerned about selling more fruit and veg, because there's this hesitance when you say, oh, you need to sell more fruit and veg, that they say, oh, I know the wastage and the risk, and yeah, it's a bit of a worry. Yeah. And a lot of time it takes quite a bit of time for that to bed in and for customers to trust convenience stores on those kind of things.
Yeah. Now let's dig into this a little bit more, Chris, because this is why I'm so excited that you're with us, because convenience stores are the shops that are in a lot of the places that we sometimes see as food deserts. They are able to sell to communities that aren't necessarily served by the bigger supermarkets. Now, can you explain to us the economic reality of running a convenience store when you've got long shelf life, sweets, cans, crisps, things like this that maybe have a really good profit margin, and you've got potatoes, tomatoes, you know, low priced, you need high volume to be able to make any profit on it. Maybe they're a loss leader in some way. What's the reality for a convenience store owner in somewhere a little bit more remote, in terms of just making a bloody profit from this stuff?
Yeah, it's a really good point, actually, because convenience stores, compared to a lot of different other businesses, hospitality for one, I mean, I appreciate hospitality has its issues, but profit margins in convenience stores are pretty tight at the best of times. Mm.
Any kind of numbers on that?
So typically margin will be around the sort of 20-25% range.
Yeah.
Whereas if you look at other businesses, obviously a lot higher than that. And yeah, especially when you're looking at, like, say, potentially risky product ranges like fruit and veg, that you have a lot of issues with wastage and all that kind of thing, then yeah, some of those at the start, they'll be potentially running those as loss leaders. I think what our members are trying to do, especially in those food deserts, like you say, those kind of areas, is to build that trust with customers and say, look, we have a range here that you can rely on. It will be here every week, and there's all kinds of other issues about, you know, what's being delivered and all that kind of thing, and quality that's coming in. But once you've built that trust, then you can start to be a bit more experimental, start to be a bit more ambitious with what you're offering. You can make salads on the premises. You can, you know, if you've got stuff that's coming towards end of life, you can cook it up into soups and serve those, and, you know, all that kind of thing that maintains the, you know, the life of the product and gives the store a bit more about it in terms of selling fruit and veg. But yeah, you're absolutely right to raise the issue of margin, because for lots of stores, they're looking over their shoulder as much as they're looking ahead and just trying to get by day to day.
Okay, so what about some radical change to the way that that we encourage people to eat food? How about we pay a convenience store a quid for every kilo of carrots they sell? I mean, I know these things are very easy to ruin by claiming you've sold these things, but you know, what about a radical move to get food out to the marginal parts of society.
Yeah, I mean, I can see that. I mean, it doesn't even have to be that radical. It just has to be inclusive. So to give one example, things like free school meals and Healthy Start are two things that convenience stores should, they should be embedded in convenience stores. Every convenience store should be offering Healthy Start vouchers for people, and every convenience store should be able to be part of the free school meals voucher scheme, and they're not. And that's not because they're not necessarily wanting to, it's because in the case of free school meals, they've been excluded from the scheme up till now. And you know, so it doesn't have to be radical. It, like I say, it just has to be inclusive, and you know, the government needs to get its thinking away from supermarkets versus then everything else, and have a more of a sort of holistic grocery look at things.
Martin, do you think that all these things that we're looking at, you know, we're using words like inequality and deprivation and you know, marginal societies and places like that. Do you think the government needs to be looking at different ideas to tackling health inequalities?
Well, I do. I mean, health inequalities are growing. We're now in the league table, probably second in the world with the highest level of inequality after the US. Yeah. I mean, the Marmot review just came out just before the COVID crisis hit, the 10-year review showing inequality had increased. I mean, basically giving people incomes is one of the key issues here, and narrowing the level of inequality between the haves and the have-nots. I mean, what was just being said there about convenience stores, we have done lots of work on this in the UK. The Scottish government particularly worked with convenience stores. And one of the things that really worked was setting up local supply chains, what are, you know, closed loop economies. So rather than, you know, buying the carrots and importing them from Glasgow, you deal with your local suppliers in rural areas in Scotland and all across the UK. I mean, similar processes. You build relationships, you keep money within local economies. I mean, the horticultural industry in the UK is in crisis. I mean, there's something like 30% of horticultural growers are living in poverty. I mean, they themselves have not got an adequate income. So we do need an inclusive approach to this, looking beyond just... it's okay to offer cheap food to people, but do people have the income to afford it? When they take it home, can they afford to turn on their ovens to cook it?
I mean, yes,
those absolutely are the realities of people living in poverty. People have to make hard decisions in poverty. We know that people are thinking about, do I turn on the heating in the house or do I turn on the oven? I mean, because what happens is those on low incomes pay a poverty premium. They're generally on card or meter systems so that their electricity costs more. So we've got to make sure they can afford the food, they can take it home, and they can prepare it in appropriate ways. And that's about adequate incomes. We also know that people in poverty make hard decisions. I mean, they're not unaware of the facts about healthy eating, but do I buy a bag of apples and the kids eat it all at once? And then I've got nothing for the rest of the week. I mean, we've done some work in Liverpool, and people talk about buying essentially pot noodles. And we say, why do you buy pot noodles? And they say, because it keeps. And at the end of the week, at the end of the month, I've still got something in my store cupboard. Mm-hmm. So people are making decisions which we may disagree with from a health perspective, but they're thinking about, I mean, it's, you could argue, is good domestic economy.
Yeah, and in that situation, maybe they're making the exact right choice that they should be.
Well,
they should be.
Absolutely. Energy-dense food fills your kit up. You know, during the last economic crisis in 2008, those on low incomes never stopped eating out on the high street. Mm. And that was because it was energy-dense food. I mean, it was, you fill your kids up, and that's your priority when you're living in poverty.
So I think we'll all agree that the government is not tackling the systemic problems, because frankly they're more complicated to solve, and they need to look as though they're doing something. But let's just bring this back to the current reality, Katie. Now, let's look at the recent the strategy that's been published. How will these restrictions or directions impact on the industry and across manufacturing and retailers, do you think?
I think they will, well, they'll have quite a large impact on the industry. So, and unfortunately, according to government's own assessment, not very much on obesity, as we've already touched on. So government, when it put round, because these actually are quite old proposals, so they were consulted on last year, it felt that the advertising restrictions would have a 2-calorie impact per day, and promotions about 15 calories. So less than 20 calories overarchingly for a day, for something that has a huge impact on the industry. Particularly, I would say, on the promotional side, although of course they link, because you know, if you're a company and you're thinking about bringing a product to market, then obviously you can promote it. That will help people to see it and notice it, or you can advertise it. You probably do a bit of both. So they kind of link quite closely together if you're looking at this from in a company mindset.
Yeah. So that presumably that would mainly affect new product launches.
It affects, it would affect new product launches, absolutely. And particularly on the promotional side, it's more likely to affect what we would say challenger brands. So maybe brand names that you're not quite so familiar with. So one of the purposes of promotions from a company perspective, is to kind of disrupt the market a little bit. So, you know, most people shop on autopilot. You kind of want to get into your store, do what you want to do and get out again. And so it's a way of kind of disrupting that. So that's particularly important on challenger brands. But it's also around, yes, new products, but actually linking it back to the reformulation program. So as I mentioned before, industry's been set quite a lot of targets to try to reformulate food. So this is typically looking at a range of products, so from sort of breakfast cereals, yogurts, chocolates, cakes, there's a lot in there. And is there a way you can make them a little bit healthier? So, you know, reduce the sugar a bit, reduce the salt a bit, those sorts of things. So they're ongoing programs. Now, if you wanted to launch a product, so take something like dairy milk, they've just got a 30% reduced, came out last year, I think now. So you've got a 30% reduced sugar chocolate bar, which the government is encouraging you to do. That, you know, that's absolutely what government has asked industry to do. But under these proposals, you can't promote or advertise it.
Yeah.
So that becomes a real problem. So it's a problem for people trying to break into the market, but I think it becomes a problem on the reformulation programs. It also becomes a problem because within those programs, the other thing we're encouraged to do is to make things a bit smaller. So again, thinking about maybe cakes or chocolates, where actually it's quite hard to reformulate. You know, sugar in a cake is not just there for sweetness. It's part of the structure of the cake. But what you could do is look at the size you sell it in. And overarchingly, then people still have cake, but they just have a bit less. And from a nutritional perspective, that's good. But the way the proposals are set up, portion isn't taken into account either. So we have this real concern that this is going to be a disincentive, basically, to innovation. And so, you know, why as a company would you invest maybe 2 or 3 years, certainly a lot of money, in trying to make something a bit healthier if you can't then bring it into the marketplace?
Mm. Martin, do you agree with this, the idea that restricting advertising hampers companies? Doesn't it make people just change their choices overall rather than harm industry?
Well, I mean, I'm in favour of restrictions. I mean, Kate probably won't be surprised to hear me say that. But
I'm sure you're not surprised that I'm not.
I've been arguing for restrictions on advertising for 30 years. I mean, it's now happened. And it's too late because the industry's moved on. They're not doing TV advertising anymore to any great extent. I mean, marketing has shifted to digital marketing. So, I mean, this is smoke and mirrors to me. I mean, I think what you do in setting standards like that, restrictions in advertising or reformulation, is you create a level playing field for the industry. I've had people from the industry say to me what they want the government to do is to have a level playing field, set the standards so they can then distinguish themselves by saying, well, we are better than that because we've reduced it by 40% and we're better than company Y. So I don't think restrictions, I mean, I think there is a cost to the industry. I think that's true. But there's a cost in product, in new product development anyway. You know, we're seeing huge numbers of new product developments at the moment, not all to do with health, some to do with technology, some to do with nanotechnology. I mean, the future, who knows what the future holds, but there is always a cost. I mean, health costs are, my problem is we're locating this outside other issues such as fair trade and modern slavery. And, you know, maybe we should be moving to a model that they've got in Brazil, which is the NOVA classification, which is based on processed food. The more you process food, the argument is the less healthy it becomes. And that's where you tax it.
And just coming back on that innovation point, and so as an example, in terms of what is currently, I mean, it's still quite vague, to be honest. So what we think it would be within the restrictions, if you take a product like mayonnaise, so mayonnaise, low fat mayonnaise and extra light, lighter than light, whatever the name is of the particular brand, all three of those would not be allowed to be promoted or advertised. So you can't, you know, if you take that category, and the same is true in a lot of the categories that they're looking at, it doesn't matter how much you reformulate it. Where the bar is set means that you cannot distinguish between those products in terms of advertising and promotions. And so that, I think, really doesn't help if you're thinking about trying to overarchingly move a market to producing healthier products. So not necessarily moving it to just buying fresh produce, but, you know, considering the range of what people put into their diet. So that would be my first comeback. The second I just wanted to pick up on was the digital. Yes, of course, digital marketing is a big thing. And actually, if you look at kids' viewing habits, so Ofcom published something pretty much year on year, and you absolutely see that shift. And I think for older children, it has, for the last year or two now, there's been more on digital than on TV. But actually, in terms of the regulation that currently surrounds children's advertising, online is already covered. And so the nutrient profile model, which is what is used to define the foods that can be advertised to children or not, that applies online as well and has done for a couple of years. And so last year, just right at the end of last year, in fact, the regulator for advertising kind of tried to work out if this was working. It's very hard digitally because, of course, what I see is not going to be the same as what a child sees because it's so targeted. So they set off these avatars, basically. It's quite cool research. If you're sort of slightly geeking like that sort of thing, which I do. But they set off avatars. So they had, I think, about seven avatars. So one was a young child, one was a teenager, one was a kid on its mum's phone, that sort of thing. And they bombarded websites, basically, to try to see. And so what they found was about 2% of ads, they were still basically seeing the foodstuffs that the regulation said they shouldn't. So obviously that is an issue. But, you know, 1 year into a new field, I don't think that's too bad. And if you unpick what they actually saw, then the majority, and this was done just pre-Christmas, the biggest, if you like, offender was actually an M&S advert for Christmas food, and they advertised a beef Wellington, and that fails. So it fails. They shouldn't have seen it. They should look into why it fails. But also, I don't think that's what people are worried about when they talk about kids seeing food adverts. And so I think there were some, and particularly YouTube, a couple of the YouTube kids channels, there was clearly an issue there. Again, if you dig into the research. And so obviously then BCAP, who's the regulator in this area, they were looking, you know, they've gone in and explored what's going on there. And so hopefully when they rerun this, those figures will be really, really down. But I think sometimes there's a perception that there's a bit of a Wild West online.
I think there is a Wild West going on. Sorry to interject, but I think it's...
Tell us more, in what way?
So we now have companies promoting materials in schools with their logos on them. You know, we have maths books with companies' logos on them. I mean, this is, we have games which are not classed as marketing with company logos on them. This is a whole new game. We're talking about advertising, and the whole world has moved on.
I mean, this shifts a lot. I'd like to bring it back to ask Chris a question, really. So, there's most of these strategy points are about things like marketing and media campaigns. What about actually tackling the way that food is sold? There's the sort of banning bog-offs, but for your members, Chris, should there be something much more different and dynamic to promote healthy diets?
Well, yes, I think so. I think that's right. I think forcing members to move their stores around and government dictating what stores look like is not the right way to do it. So, as I said earlier, the big thing that they're doing in stores in terms of intervention is about, you know, to put it very simply, sweets at checkout. And I've said already that in our stores, that's a very difficult thing to do. It's going to be expensive to implement. And from a government perspective and from an enforcement perspective, very difficult to enforce and very expensive to enforce as well, because you're going to end up with a situation where you've got enforcement officers going around to shops with tape measures and going, "Oh, your Mars bars are a little bit too close to the till there, or you've got some cakes that are a bit close to the door there. You're going to have to rip that aisle out and put something else in there." And I just don't think that's a particularly good use of anyone's time or money. We've estimated this is going to cost hundreds of millions of pounds to enforce. And you know, if the government took that money and used it for something else, I mean, your idea earlier about, you know, perhaps incentivize sales of fruit and veg in stores and have, as an example, have a member of staff as a fresh food champion that, you know, is responsible for growing those sales. I mean, this is happening. Mm. This is happening already in our stores. So one in four convenience stores have increased both the range and the sales of fruit and veg in their stores over the last year. And that's, you know, that is progress. And I appreciate, yes, we need to go further, but taking a forceful approach that is not proven to be particularly effective is not going to bring us along on this.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to have to bring this to a close, actually. So I've got one question that I'd like to ask all of you. And that is, if you were given £40 million to start to solve the UK's obesity problems, what would you spend it on? Now, £40 million is a lot of money, and it's a tiny amount of money at the same time. I'm not entirely sure how much the new strategy is being funded. But given £40 million, what would you spend it on? Kate, would you like to start off?
I think it would work best looking at a targeted intervention. I'm going to take a small amount for industry, actually. So I will take a small amount of that 40 million, not all of it, to fund something similar to actually something the Scottish government funds for far less than that, which is a reformulation manager post. And that helps all the smaller businesses look at their food and see what if they can change it to make it more healthy. Because smaller companies, which make up the majority of the industry, don't necessarily have that technical expertise. But that's only a few hundred thousand, probably. So we'll take that. And then with the remaining 39 million and a bit, I think looking at some of the local interventions, so something either like the Amsterdam model or the Henry model, which works for very young children, but actually they're basically both of those interventions, and I'm sure Martin will speak much more eloquently on this side than I could, but they're about really getting into communities, properly understanding what is driving those choices. And if it's to do with poverty, then actually putting in mechanisms that help. So for example, if you're at a school within a lower socioeconomic area, going in and doing cooking classes with both the kids and the parents, looking at the physical activity access they have. So is the green space, is there bicycle routes, those sorts of things. So there have been pilots both here and in other countries where there were some really interesting results in terms of downward trends of obesity. But because they're expensive, I think they never really seem to gather a pace, and they certainly don't gather scale. So I wouldn't use the bulk of the money for that.
Good stuff. Okay. Chris, 40 million, what are you going to splash it on?
The first thing I would be doing, and it probably would actually take up the majority of the money, is to, I mentioned this earlier, about making Healthy Start effective and universal. Because I think it's a good program. I think it works, but I think it has holes in it that mean that some people don't have access to it. So I would make Healthy Start universal and, you know, make it accessible for everyone, especially people that, you know, don't have access to bank accounts, all that kind of thing as well. And I would look at perhaps increasing the amount of money that is available for people that are eligible for Healthy Start vouchers, because I think that is a targeted intervention that does make a difference. If there was anything left over, I would look at expanding things like the Veg Power campaigns and those kind of campaigns that I think do a particularly good job at, especially helping children to be a bit less afraid of vegetables.
Yeah. Good stuff. Okay. Martin, what would you do with my £40 million?
Do a mix of the previous two recommendations. I would put it back into local NGOs. Mm-hmm. The whole local public health initiative with communities has been decimated over the last 10 years. 40 million won't be enough, but it would be a start. So I would fund NGOs, particularly those coming out of the COVID crisis, who've emerged in communities to deliver services to sections of our population who need help. But 40 million wouldn't be enough.
Yeah, it's dropping the ocean, really, isn't it? Okay, well, you've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters, and you've heard from Kate Halliwell from FDF, Chris Noyce from Association for Convenience Stores, and Professor Martin Carraher from the Centre for Food Policy, City University of London, and me, Stephen Gates. If you enjoyed this episode, you might like one of our other podcasts in which we explore pretty much every aspect of the food industry, from salmon farm sustainability to apprenticeships. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered to you on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, take a look at foodmatters.co.uk. Thank you so much to our contributors today, and goodbye. You've been listening to the Table Talk podcast brought to you by Food Matters. Subscribe to get every episode freshly delivered on Apple, Spotify, Google, or your preferred podcasting platform. And to find out more, please visit foodmatters.co.uk.